Welcome to Dig In, the podcast brought to you by Dig Insights. Every week, we interview founders, marketers, and researchers from innovative brands to learn how they're approaching their role and their category in a clever way. Hello. Welcome back to this week's episode of Dig In. Today, I'm very excited because I get to talk to my colleagues, which is always really fun. Patricia King, Denisa Priotisa, and Julian Nagar are here with me. They are all members of the Qual team. Patricia heads it up. And today we're going to talk about what the future of Qual looks like. No big deal. Just huge decisions to be made. Julian, how are you doing?
I got my crystal ball ready, so I think I'm ready to go.
Denisa, you've got a crystal ball too?
Yes, I'm actually upset because Julian got my crystal ball.
And Patricia, you're good? You're
ready to nail her? I'm just here to listen to what Julian and Denisa has to say. I'm very quiet. You're not going to hear a whole lot from me today.
I guess a little bit of context. Patricia, how big is our Qual team right now?
We are currently 15 people. And growing. So we have three full teams, two of which Denisa and Julian lead up, and we have an AVP as well. So yeah, we're growing rapidly and hiring. Anyone listening to this, please
yes,
reach out.
We are hiring. We're always hiring. You guys are some of our busiest people within the business. So I'm very happy that we were able to finally land on a time to chat. Do you guys want to, I don't know who to start with. Patricia, let's start with you. Yeah. Can you tell me a little bit about Qual at Dig and a little bit of how you sort of got started here?
Yeah, sure. So Qual at Dig is, I would say, relatively new. And I say relatively because, you know, as I'm sure lots of people know, we started back in 2010. And at that point, we were just a quant company. Fast forward 12 years later, and we are, a full service tech enabled market research consultancy. So we've definitely changed over the years. And Qual at Dig is, it's quite interesting because we saw a need from our clients that we wanted to be able we saw a problem from our clients that we wanted to solve. And so therefore we brought Qual in house. So yeah, that only started about 5 years ago. 5 years ago, it was just me. And as we mentioned, now we're 15 people, three teams, and we've really kind of tried to lean into that tech first type of Qual, which wasn't really that big of a thing 5 years ago. So it's been exciting. As for my role, I'm an EVP, so I run the whole qualitative team, and then we have Julian and Denisa.
And Julian, you come from a more traditional background in Qual?
So my Qual background is very much focus group rooms, in-person, one-on-one, ethnographies. And now I've kind of learned and grown with the team and gone more digital, as we all have with COVID, and do a lot of the B2B innovation work, stuff with regards to financial, medical, the fun stuff.
Very cool. And what about you, Denisa? What's your background?
I'm a Quali through and through, actually, starting with sociology. So that's been my background. And I've actually started Qual with many years ago. I'm going to say probably around 15 during university. And I started actually with checking respondents when we used to do that many years ago. And here I am still doing Qual. It was my first love, and apparently it's my last love. Keep doing
Don't tell your husband.
Not here. I mean, it's like so evident, even just from talking to you guys briefly, you all come at qualitative research from such a sort of unique background. I wonder sort of what kind of got you guys interested in Qual in the first place? Patricia, why did you end up going into qualitative?
Well, when you say what makes us interested in Qual, I think, normally you can't speak over all of us. We're trying to be very polite right now. But I think the fact that we all like to talk helps you get into qual, that you're extroverted and that you're curious. You just want to know how people are feeling, how they're thinking. So I think, you know, those three things combined, but really the talking helps you become a qual researcher outside of a quant researcher. But yeah, so my path to qual was very different, actually. So I'm actually a credentialed evaluator, which many people may not know what that means. But I started my career evaluating quantitative and qualitatively government programming. So I talked to youth at risk. I talked to the homeless. I talked to the underemployed. So I spent many years doing evaluation before kind of turning that into a market research career. I was working within the government and went to work for one of my market research clients. Or vendors, I should say. So yeah, I moved into market research in a very unlikely way. But you know, the 10 to 15 years experience that I had in both survey design and focus group moderation and IDI kind of made that the perfect fit for Dig Insights and being able to bring qual and quant together. And for any of you doing that math, I'm not going to tell you how long it's been. I'm obviously 29.
I hope that was not what people were just thinking as they were listening to you. They're like, I'm just going to try and figure out her age.
Very important topic of conversation.
And then Denisa, you said you started in sociology. I mean, what was that? Were you just interested in humans and human behavior? Is that sort of what led you into qual?
Yeah, I've always been interested in understanding how individuals make decisions as well as groups make decisions. And that kind of led me to sociology. And sort of this specialty that I opted for in sociology was marketing. So it's a mix of understanding how people make decisions with a marketing lens. And then I started to do checking respondents. That was my first university sort of part-time job at Synovate. And through Synovate, I discovered motivational research. They have this very cool tool called Syncidium. And that sort of opened up a whole new world for me. And I stayed.
Cool. What about you, Julian?
Yeah. So
what's your why?
A little bit of a different story. So I finished university and I studied theater and anthropology, and I was going to be an actor, but as every actor I know, I also needed to make an income. So I emailed every relative, cousin, adult that I knew saying, hey, will you employ me so that I can pursue this other thing?
That's all. People love to hear that. People love to hear that.
Well, a cousin of a cousin responded.
Will you employ me so I can...
And
amazing. Well, yeah, it worked.
She happened to work for she led a small qual shop called Hub Research and took me on as a note taker. And slowly that note-taking turned into me pursuing an MBA, maybe, you know, failing a little bit as in the theater, but using that MBA and the theater with a new organization post-MBA that trained me up in moderating, which ended up using a lot of the same skills of pulling out emotions and getting people to really express themselves with one-sided mirror and an audience behind it.
Super cool. I mean, Patricia, you've got such a diverse team here. I know there's many more, but even just from a leadership perspective, so many different backgrounds.
Very much so.
Well, I guess the fact that you guys all come from such different places means that you've also probably got some really different opinions. Hopefully, I'm hoping this is going to be a lively debate about what the future of qual looks like. I'm sure it makes you guys a much stronger team when it comes to the work you're doing with your clients. So let's dive right in. Let's get into the tricky stuff. Do we think qual was dying pre-COVID? Has it bounced back? Is it, you know, this is a huge topic of conversation. Let's start first with, was qual quote unquote dying pre-COVID? What do you guys think?
Well, yesterday we started the conversation with, yes, qual was dying, because we kind of, as you pointed out, we're a very diverse team. We have very different perspectives, which makes us stronger. We often have to agree on things before we start talking. And we had this conversation about, was qual dying? And, you know, we kind of all agreed on qual wasn't dying, traditional qual was dying. Okay. And that the market and the technology just wasn't keeping up to pace of, you know, what the world wanted to see, what our clients wanted to see. They want to see faster, easier, quicker qual that, you know, pre-COVID was, it was there. But I don't know if it was in many ways believed, if it was good. It was good. Some methodologies were good, but respondents were not good online yet. Respondents were not good at having a conversation like this. So, you know, I don't think it was qual that was dying. I think traditional qual was dying, and we just needed to find something new and innovative to kind of revive it.
Yeah. It feels like the client needs were changing, though. Like it feels like the client needs were kind of changing, and then we had to kind of adapt to that a little bit as well.
Sorry, guys. I don't want to interrupt too much. I've also just realized that we haven't really defined for the listener what traditional qual is. So maybe we could take a step back. What is that? What is traditional? Is it just in person? Is that what we mean?
That's exactly what we mean. Okay. It's in person. Okay. A lot of travel, a lot of hours in facility, or a lot of hours in a store, or a lot of hours in someone's house, actually.
And a lot of hours in big cities. Most traditional qual research was done in those focus group facilities, doing those one-on-ones, going to people's homes in big cities, because that's what was accessible at the time.
Okay. And Denisa, you were saying that the client needs were changing. Do you mm-hmm. mean that? Do you mean that it was much like Patricia was saying, they needed things faster, or were they actually needing different things from qualitative research?
I think it's both. I think it's they definitely needed things faster. I think it's also a matter of cost as well, right? With online, we were able to become more cost efficient as well. But yeah, I think there were multiple needs sort of changing, and definitely fast was one of them. Like you have to wait quite a bit for people to come out of airports to be able to get that report in your hands.
Just to like backtrack a bit, like, traditional qual was dying. Like it's, you know, it was declining. It was, you know, when I started in the field, I was told, you know, this is a shrinking and specialized field, which was not the case 20 years ago. We don't fly business class anymore, was kind of what I was told, which, you know, even in the growing, yeah. I don't think we're flying business class anymore. And, you know, from a client perspective, you know, you think about, you know, the late 90s, early 2000s, it's hard to make a business case for a $100,000 study when, you know, this big data is coming out and now we have percentages and we have numbers. And when you go to your, you know, senior leader and you come with a percentage slide and you come with a slide that has a bunch of emotions that with 12 people instead of 10,000 people, it's a very hard case to make. You know, that's shifting. Right. That's shifting now because we can find ways to do it cheaper. We can find ways to do it better. We can find ways to do it with bigger samples. But I'm sure we'll get into that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, I hadn't actually thought about this before this call, but I do these rapid fire questions at the end of the podcast with people on the client side that are like, you know, if you had, so a lot of times it's researchers saying, if you had double your budget tomorrow, what would you spend it? What would you spend it on? And I think it's like 9 out of 10 times when I ask that question, they say a qual study. Like every person says a qual study. And I think that that's really interesting when you're talking about, you know, how it's hard to justify the need for that more like emotional, you know, 12 people instead of 1200 people type of research. I know we'll kind of get into what the future of qual needs to look like.
Interesting, Megan, is that people, like most of our clients, if you look at their strategies and the way they talk about customer centricity is very much rooted in empathy. However, when you have to talk about trade-offs, we trade off on empathy. So to me, that's a market tension that I would like to point out in this discussion.
And I think one of the things we've done at Dig, when you think about how we have been innovative and how we have pushed for that tech forward, and we're going to get into later the fact that we're not always tech forward. We're back in facility all the time. We still love in person. Don't get me wrong when it makes sense. But that idea of, you know, we've kind of started to build projects that are not just qualitative projects and are not quantitative projects. I would say at Dig, 60 to 70% of the projects we do are actually qual and quant together. So right. you don't have to anymore go and say, oh, I have these 12 participants, or, oh, I have these numbers. Now you have these numbers and we can explain the why behind them, and we can give them that empathy, and we can give them those quotes. So we've kind of developed a model where we never think about, we think about the objective and then the solution, and does a qual quant solution make sense, so that clients can have both of that. And I think that's one of the reasons why we have been successful, because, you know, the companies are often separate. You have a quant company, you have a qual company. And yeah, you bring each other in when you need to, but having both in house and always thinking about, you know, I always picture that iceberg. We put it that slide in many proposals, but that idea that, you know, we get all the watts, we get all the answers, and then we have an opportunity to dive deep. And doing that as a full team just brings that extra value. So I don't think clients always have to choose now how they spend that one big bulk budget with a specific vendor.
Yeah, that's so cool. And I think that it's funny because we were talking at the beginning of this sort of a question about how client needs were changing, but in a lot of ways, they're still thinking about qual in quite a traditional way of it having to be sort of isolated from quant. I wonder if that's, I would love to go into that now of like a little bit more about how we approach that, but I don't want to skip past this idea of how your guys' opinions differ when it comes to traditional versus virtual qual research. Like, how do you kind of handle that within a team where you guys are working so synchronistically? That's not a word. Where you guys are working in sync all the time. How do you sort of handle a difference in opinion when it comes to the way that you work with those two methods?
I think naturally you're going to have affinities. Like, definitely I have more affinity towards online and towards virtual, for sure.
Julian, do you have more of an affinity towards traditional?
Yes, I do have a strong affinity for in-person. I think one of the conversations Denise and I had is just how, or what we have all talked about is, will qual just move fully virtual? And I really think there's so much value to in-person. And of course, no one wants to do the evenings, the travel, the, you know, the time away from home. Nobody really wants that. But it's sometimes needed. If you want to get to depth, if you want to read body language, you know, we talk about like how, oh, we can do a focus group online, and we can for so much, but you do miss those micro cues. You do miss those physical demonstrations of boredom, intrigue, excitement, anger, like certain things where when half of your body is hidden, you're just going to miss it. And it's not even you're going to miss it and then it's not going to end up in the report. It's you're going to miss it and you're not going to probe on it. And then you're not going to get the depth and you're not going to get the feeling. So I don't think that you need that depth of feeling for 95% of studies, but for that 5% of studies in medical, in semiotics, like you do need to go, you do need to dig.
And I would kind of jump in there with, I agree with Julian, that, you know, sometimes in person still need it, especially if it's sensory, if it's something you need to feel, if it's something you need to touch. But what I also, and this is a conversation we have often, is, you know, do we want to do in person? Do we want to be there? Do you want to do that shop along, see those micro moments? What is the objective? Because right now, if we think about the future, it's not even the future. If we think about this year, if we think about last year, if we think about 3 years ago, people are on their phones. They're taking videos. They're taking pictures. That's how they're comfortable. They're talking to their friends on Facebook Messenger or on FaceTime, and they're very comfortable behind a camera. So often, I do believe that you can get more from people, especially I think about my younger cousins. You talk to them in person, they're so awkward. All of a sudden, you get them on a video call, they're so comfortable. That's how they live, and they know how to express themselves. So I think depending on who you're talking to, what you want to see, that idea of getting rid of the moderator from the equation, being able to let them take a video, show you their home, show us what's in their fridge, show us their shopping trip. Sometimes I think depending upon the target audience and the business objective, you may get more from online.
Yeah.
There's always a time and a place for both.
I think there's a time and a place for both. But I think the emergence of technology is undeniable. And I think we just need to be at the forefront of it. That's kind of my position. And that's why I have that affinity towards online, is because there's this emergence of technology. It's undeniable. And if you deny that, then you're behind. And I'm going to be like, bye. See you later.
All right. So Dig's going all in on the metaverse now. Let's do it.
Yeah.
We are actually launching a new product.
Our metaverse avatars.
What? I would love that. Are we starting to look at the future, Julian?
I feel like as someone who's less close to, like Julian, you said 95% of the time you probably can do it virtually, but there's that 5%, and you kind of said that like healthcare or semiotics. If someone was listening to this, like where would you say you absolutely cannot do qual virtually? Is there sensory you mentioned? Is there anything else people should be aware of? Like, don't even try to do qual virtually if you're
first. I hope someone is listening to this.
If anyone. Anyone out there? Okay, no, there'll be loads of listeners. But of those people, what should they absolutely not try and do virtually with qual?
I brought up medical because that's really a lot of what my moderating training was in. If you're talking to a patient and you're talking about a rare disease, you can do that on a video call, but you won't have the box of Kleenex in front of you. You won't be able to see that, you know, potentially you're pushing the respondent too far. You need to be able to be there with the person if you're going to get them to share in a way that they may not necessarily want to share in that moment. And then you also have to know how to respect their boundaries. Those kinds of sensitive moments, I would say, need in person. Other things that, like, when you're kind of...
Oh, I was going to say another area is just honestly, like when we think about user testing, when it comes to physical products, people can see something on a screen and like it. But, you know, especially we do a lot of work in the cannabis space. You know, if you're making a new vape and, you know, you have buttons in specific places, or you have buttons that you're wondering if people are going to use, or what the lights should be and how the lights look and are they obvious? Those are things where, you know, we definitely have to go back in the facility. I think most user testing, not online, but with physical products, package testing, again, you know, is it convenient? How does it go in a microwave? How does things break up? You know, those types of things I think you still need to be in facility for.
Yeah.
100%. And I think we have not figured out a way. Here's the thing that I always like to think about, which is, especially when you think about product testing, and there's a lot to be said in terms of product testing and moderator bias in that moment. And to me, the most pure way of doing product testing sometimes is to actually give that product to a person at home and have them interact with that product at home without me being there breathing down your neck and drawing your attention to that button or drawing your attention rip the seal that maybe the client thought to place in a place where it's not visible and so on and so forth. So to me, there is some, it's still very expensive. I think we are doing it, but it's still kind of expensive. But 100%, there's something to be said in terms of how do people actually naturally interact with certain products, with certain packages, with certain... How do they actually taste it in their own kitchen, for example, without me being there.
So, sorry, this is probably kind of a naive question. I've never run qual research. So, like, when you're saying in their home, I think that's a really interesting point. Are you saying that you send someone something, they open it, and they're on video while they're doing it, but you're not sort of prompting them? Okay. That's very interesting.
That's where you ask us about what kind of tools we're using.
So, yeah, what kind of tools are you using?
We are using all sorts of tools, but... but definitely there's something to be said of the combination and the hybrid. And I think qual is going to mirror what we're doing in our life, in our day to day for sure as well, right? We are in a hybrid environment still. Yeah. I think we're going to continue to be in a hybrid environment. I think there's a place and a time for all of these things. And it depends on the target that you have. It depends on the, like, maybe you don't have a finished product. If you don't have a finished product, then what am I going to send you home? There's nothing I can send you home. You have to come to me in facility and we can discuss about a mock-up and so on and so forth. So there's definitely a time and a place for both, but more online.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Oh, you guys are agreeing?
We're
agreeing. It's amazing.
We're agreeing. Okay. But last point is that, you know, you got to say in person's more fun.
It is. 100% it is more fun. I was just doing some groups on packaging, and you could see when people were like underwhelmed by what was happening with that packaging, which was so obvious. Like, you could just call it out, and there was that very obvious underwhelmed feeling with like people just and you don't see it as well in online for sure.
I feel like I kind of want to go back to this idea of customers being more comfortable, or people being more comfortable behind a screen. I think that's really interesting, and it's not really something I've thought about, but I think even when we think about, you know, remote working, presenting remote, like, there's so many people who are just so much more comfortable doing things that might be quite nerve-wracking in person, behind a screen. And I'm wondering, like, do you guys have any examples where that has been more effective? Like, when has that been more effective? I know you can't cite specific clients, but is there anything you can speak to on that?
I think we have lots of examples. I'm just thinking, you know, right now we do a lot of, I'll call them mobile shop-alongs. Maybe we want to call them mobile safaris, where we ask people to take us along to the grocery store. I'm thinking about a specific project where we wanted to know if they're noticing the new communications in the store. It was actually redone. There were new screens, new signage, new directions, lots of new information. And we were able to use our client list. We knew, you know, that shoppers that went to that location often. And we asked them just to go around the store, do their normal thing. And before they check in, get all their groceries, act completely normal, which you couldn't have done in the days when we were observing. When they went to check in, say, before you check in, now we want you to do a little task for us. And we can send them around the store and say, okay, now do a walk around the store. Take pictures. What's different? Tell us what's different. Then we can say, okay, now go look. Did you notice this? Did you notice that? And they might be like, yeah, absolutely. I actually looked at that sign in my shop during my shop. Didn't realize it was new, but it was helpful. And then, you know, they'll leave the store. We'll ask a couple more questions. They upload their selfie videos on very unmoderated interview. And then we can take some of those people once they get home and they've rethought it and bring them into an interview. So one, you get a lot of time with them. You get a lot of effort with them. But again, you remove that whole entire bias. So they got to do a shop more comfortably. They got to do their real shop. They were able to take an extra 10 minutes to go back through the store. And yeah, then when you call them, they are, you know, one, you get great selfie videos. You always get great selfie videos. everyone's happy to take a selfie video. But when they come back, like, you just see it on their face. So like, oh, like, I didn't see that. Like, that was so funny. I can't believe I missed it. I go there every second day. I think a lot of that you wouldn't necessarily get if we were there in person. And, you know, it's hard to say, would that shopper be as open if we were in person? Maybe. But we know post COVID that some people are not. And I think, you know, one, they're comfortable, but two, they some people are just not back to that socializing, want to be next to a stranger having that conversation.
Can I say something that I noticed actually is that people are definitely more comfortable online. And I've noticed the difference between focus groups online, when I do focus groups online versus focus groups in person. When you're in person, you're less likely to be super transparent because you are for sure going to have all of your systems activated. Whereas when you're online, you feel obviously more protected and yeah. you definitely feel more compelled to be more transparent. Right? Because you are more protected. There's no one right there next to you yeah. in your personal space. And I think people are actually a lot, like they are not as afraid to be a-holes online versus person.
This, good job not swearing, Denisa.
Yeah, good job.
I loved that.
There's also, you get these nice moments online sometimes where, you know, we did this one study on baby food and, you know, you end up with these videos with all these babies, which is like so much fun and it makes it real. Or, you know, all of a sudden the parent takes out all, like you're doing it on food and they take out all the stuff out of their pantry and they take their camera and they show you the table and they go through, see, this is, you know, Doris, my baby. I don't know why I chose Doris as a name, and I don't think that's a good baby name. I'm sorry, I apologize. Anybody whose baby's name is Doris. A great, beautiful baby name. Anyways, baby loves her, you know, snacks. Anyways, you have these beautiful moments in people's homes. You have the handing off of the baby from one parent to another. There's some nice impromptu moments. You know, we did a banking interview where we were talking with one partner and you know, he's saying, oh, I don't remember which savings account has XYZ. And then he calls his spouse into the room and they're having a whole conversation in front of you. And you get that real visibility into how decisions are made, how,
that's what I love online.
Yeah. Like who
owns wait, what did you say, Denisa? That's why you love online.
Yeah, because facilities are good for a lot of things, but they're formal. And I think sometimes people forget that they're formal and they formalize a certain discussion and they formalize the way people are going to respond to you. And they definitely bring out the self-defense mechanism a lot more than it happens online. In online, I'm already protected by a screen. When I'm in person, I have to have my self-defense mechanisms up. And therefore, I'm going to pull back.
But Denisa, you know, a great moderator will disarm those defenses.
I agree. I completely agree. But you will not see when the wife reminds the husband about the password. You won't see that.
This is my life.
I feel like we could probably talk about this forever. Like, it's so interesting, this idea of what's lost and gained in either sort of method.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think as we think about the future of Qual, Megan, I know that's going to be like your next question or the one after. But as we think about that, you know, I was in Berlin only a few months ago for Qual 360. And that was the whole entire conference. It was empathy in a tech world. I don't know if that was exactly the name of it, but the whole entire conversation for 3 days was around how do we keep empathy, but how do we move with technology? How do we move with our consumers? And how do we kind of do that in a world where, you know, our clients get what they want and get the answers that they want, and it's still a customer-centric approach. But, you know, again, we have our speed, we have our increased participants, we have a bigger line of sight into their lives. When you think about online journals and online diaries and mobile ethnographies, we get more time with people than we ever had. And we get more time with a single mom. That was the example I used yesterday. Pre-COVID, you were in a focus group room, you didn't have a single mom in the room. When was a single mom getting the time? You didn't have a single mom from rural Saskatchewan, I can tell you that. So, you know, you also have now increased your reach and you can talk to more of your consumers than a more new niche group of consumers.
Yeah, that's really amazing. Like this idea that you're increasing representation by kind of I'm so tired of the word democratizing, but it's true, like democratizing access to people who might not have had the time, frankly, to do this previously. Julian, were you going to say something?
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, it's even a difference from pre-COVID to now. Of pre-COVID, if you wanted to do online stuff, there were access issues to that too. Not everybody had a stable internet connection. You know, not everyone had a fast enough computer to run Zoom. Zoom didn't even like really exist 3-4 years ago. And now everybody has, or more or less everybody, has good access, and we can get to more people in more places, and it definitely democratizes.
And I think that's a good point in that, yeah, we could have done online focus groups 3 years ago. We did a lot of online discussion boards, communities, those types of online activities. But one, the technology wasn't, you know, COVID just sped up technology development, innovation so quickly. But two, it made us more comfortable doing this. So I could have done an online focus group 3 years ago. If I was asked to do an online focus group, I'd be like, why? Can we do it in person?
Yeah.
Can we do it through a discussion forum? Can we do it another way? People, consumers were so awkward, and we're now past that. So going back to that comfort idea, right? But it's the people have changed, but also the technology, the innovation, where we can go, what we can do is just so much better.
And when we think about the innovation of, you know, virtual, being able to use a lot of different sort of methods for qual, would you say that that is part of the reason it's easier to sort of integrate quant and qualitative research at DIG? Like, would you say that technology plays a key role in that?
100% it makes it easier. First of all, you can tap into the quant. Like, let's start with the most basic way, which is you can actually tap into the quant respondents and recruit them for a follow-up call. That's number one, easiest. You can get that why behind the what like this. And that's technology. That's one way. The second way is the fact that it just makes communications within teams and between teams way faster and way more efficient. So that's another way that technology plays a role. Also the way we integrate our methodologies, like they're just meant to live together and breathe together. And the way we think about the recommendations, it's always sort of holistic, integrated. It's never Denisa's going to go on, tell her story, and then the quant VP is going to go on and tell their story. It's always, what is that sort of holistic story that we're going to tell? And what are those holistic recommendations that we're going to put forward?
Yeah, we ran a study that started 3 weeks ago and was done 1 week ago. So it was 2 weeks from kickoff to execution, to kind of final report delivery. And it was a qual quant study. And this is just a huge plug for our Upside platform, because we were running the qual in tandem with the quant. And as we're running the study, and it was a very kind of relatively straightforward study of comparing two potential name options for a brand. But as we're running the qual, as I'm doing the interviews, I have the dashboard up for Upside, watching what the quant respondents are kind of voting, comparing, you know, how they're responding. And I'm able to adapt the discussion, knowing that one of the concepts is leading, knowing that, okay, this is what we need to share more about. And that's all happening live. That's all happening in the moment. And then, you know, we're getting on a call with the quant VP and we're like, okay, what is the story? You know, all within 2 weeks. I don't think we could have done that 6 months ago or a year ago. Like, that's how much technology is impacting what we do.
It's really cool. I'm conscious of time. So we've got a little bit more time, and I want to ask you the hardest question of all, which is, what is the future of qual?
One of the things, so first, I think, you know, everything swings one way and has to swing back the other a little. And right now, you know, the world has swung highly to tech because it has to be in the tech space. We haven't been able to see consumers face to face in the last 3 years, especially not in Canada. But it will swing back. We're back in facility. We're in facility next week, the week after, we're back. But I think the future of Qual is there's going to be more innovation. There's going to be more tech, and we're going to do it better. You have so many great platforms that, you know, we work with that are developing amazing tools. And inside of that, it's how do we build within Dig, and how do we innovate within Dig? And, you know, while we got, you know, we've been very lucky that we were in the tech space pre-COVID and we stayed in the tech space. And obviously we grew, you know, we've tripled in size in the last 3 years within our Qual team because we were ahead of that curve. It's how do you stay ahead of that curve? And, you know, one of the things that, you know, we spent a lot of time on is not just what technology we can use to do online online qual, but it's also how we analyze our online qual. One of kind of the I can't say the pitfall of qual, but no matter how fast and easy you do it, you know, when someone says, "Hey, I want to collect 3,000 videos," I look at them and say, "Well, what are you going to do with those 3,000 videos?"
Right.
The analysis time is just so massive. So, you know, one, at Dig specifically, I know we're looking at how do we build quant studies with more qual in them. Instead of having to do a big qual study, can we do something that's brings that consumer to life within our quantitative work? And one example of that, and a plug not even for our platform, but a great partner is Canvas AI, which is emotional sentiment tracking tool. So we're able to now put more qualitative voice to some of our quantitative work. Outside of that, there's eye tracking software now. There's tracking on people's phones, but also listening to their voice and their emotion. You know, right now on our Upside platform, we're looking at ways that we're going to integrate more qual into that. Stay tuned. And the last thing, and then I'll be quiet and let Julian and Denisa talk, is AI. And, you know, I just talked about Canvas AI ran emotional sentiment tracking, but our analytics team, the work they're doing is just amazing. And, you know, we've been working closely with them to look at how we can better analyze our qualitative work using AI. And, you know, obviously people are not going to go away. Qualitative is completely, you know, it's reading it, understanding it, theming it, and then writing a story that often comes from the feeling you got in the room. But if AI can help us speed some of that up and help us get there, it will kind of, I think that could potentially be a big game changer when you think about qualitative research and what we can do.
Julian, Denisa, that was such a great answer. Patricia, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I mean, that's quite the act to follow.
Denisa, do you have anything to add to Patricia's?
I honestly think like my gut tells me that AI is going to change definitely some things, and is going to change how we potentially analyze, as Patricia said. I truly believe that. I mean, we threw it in as a joke, but I'm very curious to see what happens in metaverse. I'm very curious. It's like I know it feels like a joke, but Zoom felt like a joke some years ago. Recollect felt like a joke some years ago, but I don't think it's a joke. I honestly think there's something to be said about virtual reality, and I'm very curious to see how that's going to evolve. It's still in a nascent stage for sure. It's too expensive still, and it's kind of clunky still. But there's something to be said there. But the first step for sure is going to be dabbling a lot more with AI and having AI help us sort of do our jobs more efficiently.
Julian, anything to add?
I think we'll have to wait for Doris to be all grown up for the metaverse to start having a role. no. Okay, for anyone listening, they're all shaking their heads at me. I don't know. I mean, I think
I think that you know, the reality is the role of qual is gonna keep growing. We've all kind of acknowledged or seen that we live in this very unpredictable reality. The type of research we did last year is, the content isn't even the same as what we're doing this year. The world is a vastly different place. I don't even know what's going to happen tomorrow. And so if things change so fast, we have to stay close to our customers. We know brands and companies are being super vigilant, wanting to get the pulse of their customers. And so I think there's just a lot of room for qual to grow, whether it's AI, the metaverse, I don't know. But I know there's definitely going to be lots to come.
Thank you guys so much for today. This has been very interesting as someone who doesn't get to do qual or talk about qual in my everyday life. And I'm sure that the listeners are going to learn a lot. So thank you. And I'll talk to you soon. Tune in next week.
Thank you.
Bye. Thanks for tuning in this week. Find us on LinkedIn at Dig Insights. And don't forget to hit subscribe for a weekly dose of fresh content.